The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is Naomi Shihab Nye, and she is Whitter Benner Fellow at the Library of Congress this year. She's going to read us an opening poem so that we can hear her voice and say hello.
Hi, Grace. It's wonderful to be here. Magnetic Poetry Kit. I'm more interested in words that fall off the refrigerator door by themselves than the lanky lines we make. Urge, alone, on a red tile, in a little pool of light.
Naomi Shihab Nye. Do any people just say Naomi Nye?
Certainly, and
they
you're
do
welcome
everything.
To say that.
They
sure.
say everything about you.
Call me by any name.
Right. She lives in San Antonio and has just come in to be with us. She is married to the photographer Michael Nye and has a 14-year-old son who I feel I know very well because his life is threaded through her work. And through it has led her to work with children all over the world. Her recent books include Fuel. This book is a special favorite of mine, so I'm going to be pushing her to read a lot from it. And then a novel for teens. What is the title of that?
Habibi.
And that has won 5 awards?
It has, miraculously, yes.
Different ones?
Different ones.
Not the same
different
one over
book
and over?
Awards. No,
well,
it has.
How does that fall?
Well, it was very heartening since it was my first novel for teens, and in fact, to this day, I don't feel very comfortable using the word novel. I think of it more as a long story. And I love to talk to students about how hard it was for me, a person who's used to writing things that are 1 page or 2 pages or 10 at the, you know, the most length, to write something 200 pages. And they love to hear about how hard it was because, of course, for many of them, writing is tantalizing but also occasionally difficult.
And short-lived.
Yes.
Right. So we're going to hear about the difference, the process in prose and poetry as we proceed today. But right now I want to hear about your poetry. I would like to hear some more of it and share your voice with the world. So give us our poem.
I'll read Hidden. If you place a fern under a stone, the next day it will be nearly invisible, as if the stone followed it. If you tuck the name of a loved one under your tongue too long without speaking it, it becomes blood, sigh, the little sucked-in breath of air hiding everywhere beneath your words. No one sees the fuel that feeds you.
The voice of Naomi Shihab Nye. I look at the way that you make a poem, and we've heard 2 examples of them so far, and I realize about wanting a poem to have gravity. You have talked about making it accessible. Those are the 2 things which are, I think, the reason for your fame, frankly. People can taste what they eat in your work. But you do something else, and that is you make weird connects that are tentatively and magically coming together that work. Now, how do
you... Thank you, Grace.
How do you teach people?
Well, I'm very touched by what you say because I like the word weird, and I've always liked it since I was a child. I remember my brother asking me when we were children, how does it feel to know that other people think you're weird? And I said, and no one had ever been honest enough to say that to me before, and I remember saying to him, well, now that you say it, it feels fine. I like the word weird because when things are weird in the world, they tend to be unexpected, surprising. They trigger a new thought. They challenge us by way of linkage or whatever. So, you know, I don't know if you can actually teach people to make linkages, but you can teach them to pay attention to details and to be aware of mysteries, which I believe are everywhere around us all the time.
But you know how far out on the limb to go and to make it work. There is a little bit of velvet at one of your poems. At one of your poems, your little piece of velvet there. And how do you explain that? I could not explain why you chose to put that pulsing at the end of the poem. But, you know, it actually works. Now, anybody, but the fact that you have that barometer that knows how far to push reality and still keep it within sensibility, that's what I'm marveling about. I don't think you can teach that.
Thank you very much, Grace.
How do
well, you know, I don't. Can we teach attitudes toward life? Can we teach a kind of chipper belief in the sturdiness and faith in the magic of words. You know, can we teach that? It's contagious. It comes to many of us first in our own lives through the reading of poetry or through listening to poetry. And I know as a little child hearing poems, I felt very satisfied with the way language came together in the poem, and nothing was dangling, nothing else was needed, no explanation necessary. There was something so gratifying about that to me. A child that I guess as we grow and we try to write our own poems, we're always hoping that we can find some kind of balance within what is described and what is unsaid. And therein lies
in between those two things.
That little tether, that little tether line of poetry, which is so wonderful, and why many people feel that it defies a certain kind of explanation. Well, it does, and it wants to.
Well, the wonderful thing I can say is that I have this week in bed with your book but since we were going to be together today, I thought I'm just going to read a poem a night like the Bible. And upon reading it, I said, I know how to write poetry. I know why we write poetry. I know what poetry is. And isn't it that we need to be reminded by the last book we read that I feel so invigorated by this book. So I'll tell everybody the name of it. It is Fuel. It is out by BOA. And it isn't that old a book, is it?
No, a couple of years old.
Yeah, 2 years old. Yes. And you have something coming up in the future. What is your next book?
Well, I have a book called Mint Snowball, which is sort of, it's a collection of prose pieces, paragraphs. Some people would call them prose poems. I call them paragraphs in this book, and I tell why I do that. And it's coming up from Anhinga Press in Florida. And it is part of a book called Mint, which first came out in the early 90s. Part of that book is contained in this book, but there are also many newer pieces. That's how it grew into Mint Snowball. So it is a collection of these paragraphs.
The voice of Naomi Shihab Nye. I am Grace Cavalieri. We are at the Library of Congress. Naomi is the Witter Binner Fellow this year, and she's come all the way from San Antonio to be with us, tell you a little bit about her. In addition to her own work, she has edited 6 prize-winning anthologies of poetry for young readers, and they are named This Same Sky, The Tree Is Older Than You Are, The Space Between Our Footsteps, which includes poems and paintings from the Middle East, What Have You Lost, and Salting the Ocean, and we will find out about each of those later. Right now, we'd like to find out about another poem.
I'll read Pictures from the Village, which is in the book Mint Snowball coming up, and it takes place in the West Bank. Your faces carry a different light. Because the soldiers poke you in the backs with their guns, because you have worried your whole lives long about every inch, every step, every child, every tree. What gets better, year to year? The Israelis say they are sick of you. They say it to your faces. Your house is 200 years old. They act like you just arrived. How many stones do they have over there anyway? Asks an American, reading the newspaper. The major crop. Quiet shine, undersides of leaves veined and ripe, intricate traceries of labor, steady gaze of constellations radiating in place, whether or not we give them names.
Would that be one of the themes of the book, or is that a discrete poem?
No, it's a discrete poem. There are a few poems which connect to the situation in Palestine/Israel, or Israel/Palestine, or Jerusalem, or the Holy Land, or however way you refer to it. There are quite a few, as there have been those pieces threading through all my work from the beginning.
Your father was from Palestine.
He's from Palestine. He grew up, was born there, spoke Arabic as a child and English, and lived in the Old City and lost his home. His family lost all their possessions in 1948, as so many thousands, millions of Palestinians did. It was not an
Your
unusual
grandmother,
situation.
She, did you
yeah.
know her?
I did, and she lived to be 106 in the West Bank after losing her home in Jerusalem, and she was quite an amazing character, and many of my poems have referred back to her or attempted to invoke her spirit, her presence.
I believe there is much of this ahead of you, too. I can't believe that these roots that you carry, that you're finished with yet. As things intensify there, surely they have to within your heart. It must be very, very difficult. When your uncle went back there, is that where he went? The one who died after returning home?
Yes, he did. And
that is a fabulous poem. Let's hear that poem.
Thank you. And many cousins.
It's about the luncheonette.
Well. Yes, the luncheonette, the Texas luncheonette. It's a restaurant in Texas that many people go to called Jim's, a local San Antonio place. And my uncle, as an immigrant, loved this place. My uncle's favorite coffee shop. Serum of steam rising from the cup. What comfort to be known personally by Barbara. Her perfect pouring hand and starched ascot, known as the two easy eggs and the single pancake, without saying. What pleasure for an immigrant, anything without saying. My uncle slid into his booth. I cannot tell you how I love this place. He drained the water glass, noisily clinking his ice. My uncle hailed from an iceless region. He had definite ideas about water drinking. I cannot tell you all the time, but then he'd try. My uncle wore a white shirt every day of his life. He raised his hand against the roaring ocean and the television full of lies. He shook his head back and forth from one country to the other, and his ticket grew longer. Immigrants had double and nothing all at once. Immigrants drove the taxis, sold the beer and cokes. When he found one note that rang true, he sang it over and over inside. Coffee, honey. His eyes roamed the couples at other booths, their loose banter and casual clothes. But he never became them. Uncle, who finally left in a bravado moment after 23 years, to live in the old country forever, to stay and never come back. Maybe it would be peaceful now, maybe for 1 minute. I cannot tell you how my heart has settled at last. But he followed us to the sidewalk, saying, take care, as if he could not stand to leave us. I cannot tell how we felt to learn that the week he arrived, he died, or how it is now, driving his parched streets, feeling his booth beneath us as we order. Oh, anything. Because if we don't, nothing will come.
The voice of Naomi Shihab Nye. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Good point to make you read that poem, because you approach sadness, but you are not a sad poet.
Thank you.
You are not. It is interesting, and that is one of the reasons why people like your work. You're not a downer. You may describe an event, and we know how the heart is enlarged because of it. But you don't kvetch. You know, we don't hear about you might have. You'd say the morning opens with a sad sack, or you might have a little. But you are basically a poet of optimism. Is that
Thank you, Grace.
A true thing to say?
I think it's true.
Why is that?
Well, I think we have a choice. And, I mean, we have to contain sadness, certainly, because it will be finding us wherever we go. And we can't deny it. We can't pretend it isn't there. But we have a choice about what to do after that. And I felt, since I was a very small child, that you know, you could either stop there and be sad and complain and pout and whine and moan and all the things we do when we are sad. Regret. Regret was a subject that I've written about more later. But we also can do something which gives us more energy, which is try to move on beyond that. Or, as my friend writer Marie Brenner has said, stand back from the negative. She says, you know, it's important for us to acknowledge there are all these negative things. We need to know about them. We need to be informed. But stand back from them. Don't let them claim you. Don't let them be the final word. Because as we feel, the sadness often doesn't help us do more, see more, know more. It stops us.
More than other poets, though. Oh. I think more than other poets, you have found a way of changing the some sort of alchemy of changing what could be a depressing event into a possibility. I tend to stay with the depression myself.
I doubt that, hearing you.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of poets, though, do make a meal out of that. You know, we bring our crippled child to the table, the maimed child, and then we move on, sure. But some way, as you say, early on, you made an active decision. I'm going to, when you're on a high stool in front of this class and your teacher is saying you sit there for laughing too much, you look out the window and find the edge of sky. And that sums up very much what I think about how you work.
Well, it's almost like the next movement in a piece of music. You know, you have the movement when you acknowledge sadness, when sadness overtakes you, often like a tidal, as if it's a tidal wave. You know, it just takes you up and you're suspended there within it. But then there's this other movement possibility. And to me, it's very important to make that movement, to find where it can be, how you can move on with that information, with that knowledge. How could you carry it or it carry you to something else?
I'm very glad you said that, because I was wondering if people had acknowledged that publicly about your work, which I think is a keynote of your work, actually. If we were to write an essay about you, that's what I would write about.
I appreciate
having time
that.
Now. We have to keep going on the program.
I appreciate you saying that very much.
So let's keep going, because we're at the Library of Congress and we love it here very much. And we'll hear another poem in honor of being a Witter Binner Fellow.
Oh, that's very kind. Shrine of Hair. Now, this is a paragraph. It stands or falls according to its morning whim. He grips the comb, bites his lip, staring into an antique mirror that makes every face look wider than it really is. He's furious at how fast hair grows. Doesn't it know he wants it to be short and stiff, standing up like a small wall in front, in the style of some Latino singing star? Instead, it bends or separates, slouching to the right. Then there is the issue of school, the coming trapped hours, while the lucky cat lounges on the step all day, licking and licking his own gray sheen.
I asked Reed Whittemore what a prose poem was, and he said, it's a French form. That's all anyone knows. No one knows what a prose poem is. Well, you start at one margin, and you go to the next margin. What do you think a prose poem is?
Well, I think a prose poem is very much like a poem, but I also think that for some people, for many people, it has a more comfortable demeanor. If you're not comfortable with that space around the poem, which many of us adore, I love the space around broken lines in a poem, but many people who don't grow up reading a lot of poetry feel nervous about that space, as if they're supposed to be figuring something very difficult out when they get to the end of a line. And so for them to read a prose poem is often a more comfortable, easygoing attitude they may take as a reader, because they think, oh, a paragraph, I know what a paragraph is. You know, it's like this mini story. Mm-hmm. So there's just a different feeling. Now, why some things are written as a prose poem remains a mystery to me.
Well,
but I tend to write in the prose poem form in my journal often, and often, as well as writing in the kind of loose first draft poem form in my journal. And the things which start as prose poems in the journal, as little paragraphs, often stay that way. And it's hard to say why. I really can't help you solve that.
However, it does have something to do with the content. I'm convinced that there is, in the expanded line, less tension, maybe no anger, no compression. There has to be something that you're writing about that fits the relaxation.
Yes, a kind of narrative that doesn't tend to leap. Perhaps in as many ways, or maybe simply it will leap in one way and just find a way to contain that in the visual line itself as a paragraph.
Well, let's hear another prose poem to see if we can tell the difference.
Why?
I wonder if the ear can tell.
Well, since we're in the library, I'll read Library Card. Someone has forged my library card. The second me favors philosophy, aesthetics, theories of evolution. We evolve into people who are not ourselves. The imposter is smarter than I am. The imposter likes checking out better than returning. But we have our own troubles. 18 lost books from the children's department turn up in an ice chest in our shed 9 months later. They are well cooled and rested. How big can a fine be? The library will try to intercept the impostor at the checkout desk. We'll ask them to name my birthday. Aha! Someone without an address of their own borrowed yours. How many things we haven't thought of yet. Someone is everywhere. We share periodicals, elevators, bathrooms. A glimpse into gloom and the quickly turned head. Someone drinking out of the hose in my front yard. Think what a book offers otherwise. Never mind. Shall I foot your bill? Don't be gone. Read on. What better thing to do? March 12th, 1952.
How characteristic to donate your library card to some poor soul.
The funny thing is, since the day I wrote that, I did not receive any more of those forms for all the books that I allegedly had checked out that I hadn't. See what I mean? But weirdly, since the day I put that on a page, I kind of offered up, and I read it at the library. We all read things to inaugurate our fabulous new library in San Antonio. So I read it publicly. And, you know, I wondered that
could
even be
here. The culprit was in the audience.
Could be there. Yeah, could be there. But maybe they're still checking out books on my card, but now they return them on time. I don't know. I have never received one of those again. And I was receiving them 3 times monthly for long lists of books.
Oh, the thief of overdue. Oh, that is so funny. I thought it was imagined, but it really is.
No, it's really
a true.
True
story.
No, it's true. Yes. For about a year, I received these
overdue notices?
Overdue notices for books I'd never
heard
of.
What kind of books were they checking out?
Well, they were these philosophy, aesthetics of evolution. And so when I say in this little paragraph, we evolve into people who are not ourselves, I'm joking about the fact that they keep checking out these books about evolution. And then I'm also impressed with the books they're checking out because they sound much harder than the books I'm checking out.
Well, you must have made a contribution in some way to some future son. This book is published, that person will be sort of anonymously famous, included in your book. Well, we've talked about your poetry and a prose poem a little. I would really like to know how you proceeded to write a novel, just in process.
Well,
you got up in the morning and...
And I wrote, not in order, many, many chapters relating to a young girl who moves overseas with her family, as I did at the age of 14. And I set the book in Jerusalem in a neighborhood that I knew, and I sent her to the school that I had gone to, the Armenian school, St. Tarkmanchats in the Old City. And I used flavors of my city, my grandmother, in the book. All the characters are really fictional, although the grandmother is more based on herself than anyone else in the book. And the story is fiction, although, of course, that's been one of the most common questions children have asked me is, but you did this in your own life, so how can you say this is fiction? I say, well, I did that in my own life, but I've paralleled it. I haven't told my story of what happened. I haven't told you about the friends I made, and I don't feel the main character is myself. I feel like she's her own character. So I said, I set it in a place that was very real to me that I could describe.
But why is it a teenage novel?
Well, I wrote hoping to appeal to that age, and I was thinking of that age. She is 14 when the book starts and 15 when it ends. And frankly, Grace, I can't even imagine. I can't fathom writing a novel for adults, although I love reading them. I just don't feel that my calling.
When you grow up.
Thank you. When I become confident. Maybe.
The thing is that it's alive in you, an elfin child who lives on and writes on, it is true, and a mischievous child at that. But the teenage market is very interesting because you can't really, you have to just tell your story. You can't really gear it to public opinion because who knows what is out there.
That's right.
And also it usually gets placed at a lower age group. The 14-year-old hero appeals to the Twitter. So it's very...
Absolutely
you
right.
You can't worry about it, right?
No, you can't worry about it. And, you know, the gratification I have had reading... Well, I've met a lot of students who've read the book. In Texas, I'm invited to schools where they've read it as a sixth grade assignment, for example.
And do they like it?
Well, it's phenomenal, the things that they want to talk about in it. And they're such great readers, and they're so caring about the characters. And so many of them have said that about the Middle East. We needed to hear an Arab-American voice because we haven't heard one before. We didn't know what that voice sounds like. We didn't know what she would care about. And, of course, many of them who only know about the Middle East from newspapers, they need else to inform them about the region. So I've felt very happy to make theirs that way.
Let's skip over to the book then called The Space Between Our Footsteps, which does feature the Middle East. A cool thing to do.
Well, thank you. I love the book. I think it's a very beautiful landmark book. I'm very proud of its elegance as well.
Describe what's in it.
Heart. Writings by writers of many, many Arab countries, a few North African writers, Turkish writers, and paintings as well by writers in all the Arab countries, as well as writers from Israel. Now, that was a bit controversial of my possible contributors. One painter and one poet had problems with that. I could understand especially the poets, since he had been blinded in a confrontation, and so he did not want to have his work presented alongside the work of Israelis. And I said as argument to these two, but I want them to read you. I want them to read this book. If I become a separatist, if I say, no, I won't include them in the book, even though they're in the same region, what does that say about what I'm promoting? The region? Now, I'm a person who believes that we could all work together in a collaborative way, and I believe in culture. I'm not editing this book as a politician, money for arms in this book. I am sharing voices. And furthermore, I'm the editor of the book, so I'm selecting the poems that I want to place side by side. You know, the poem by... and is placed side by side with Hanan Ashrawi's poem, they're there together for a reason. I mean, if anyone reads those two together, I think they'll get a sense of why I might have put them together. And so I was very happy that most reviewers were quite warm to this book.
Why do you call it a book for young readers?
It's for everybody. I think it's for everybody. But I published it with my editor, Virginia Duncan, who was at Simon & Schuster at the time we did that book and is now at Greenwillow, and that's our audience for the press. And so we were with Simon & Schuster Books for Young Readers, wonderful press. And
you have done more work, I think, with young readers in anthologies than any other practicing poet at this moment. Come With Me poems?
That's a new collection of my poems for young readers. And you're sweet what you say, Grace, but I think there are many people, Paul Genesco and Liz Rosenberg and so forth, who've
done. They put out single anthologies, not multiple ones.
Well, no, Genesco's done probably a dozen or two. And Liz Rosenberg has done beautiful books. And there are many other people I could name who've done wonderful anthologies. I appreciate what you're saying, though, because one thing I really care about is making books which lift us into their poetry, which don't condescend. I think there are many anthologies for young readers which I have felt personally have a patronizing tone or condescending tone or tend to select poems which are cute as opposed to really thoughtful, wonderful poems. And I'm not interested in cute poetry very long. You know, I can be interested in one or two cute poems, but I would have no interest in editing a book of cutesy poems. Mm-hmm. So I think there are other people who've done that, and they can do that well and keep doing it. But I wanted to use poems which were honorable, strong, powerful poems that had all the elements in them which adults appreciate in poetry, and yet they also had to be have a certain kind of appeal for teenagers.
We are at the Library of Congress and the program.